Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Nicole Fari. For the first 40 years of her working life, she was, of course, a fashion designer, preoccupied with how to make us look good from the neck down, in timelessly fluid styles, underpinned by a classically continental sensibility. In a notoriously fickle industry, she stayed the course, ending up with eponymous stores in New York, London and Tokyo. But that was then. Now her creativity's more concerned with matters from the neck up. At the stage when many of us decide to take it easy, she has reinvented herself, becoming a critically acclaimed sculptor, producing works in bronze, glass and concrete. Born and raised by her Turkish-Jewish family in Nice, as a child she made clothes for her dolls. Each August, as a teenager, her style-conscious aunts would whisk her along to couture shows by the likes of Balenciaga and Yves Saint Laurent. Her first tentative foray into fashion was as a hard-up student in Paris, selling her little sketches to magazines. She says, "I don't look down on what I've done for 40 years. I was a fashion designer and every day I enjoyed what I was doing. But I don't want to spend time thinking about fashion now. I don't find it that important. I haven't shopped since I left. I haven't bought one T-shirt. This is another life, a new life starting." So welcome, Nicole Fari.
Thank you.
Tell me then a little bit about being a sculptor, because fashion is inevitably, I imagine, a very collaborative process, whereas being a sculptor is being alone in your studio with a piece of material to work. What do you need around you when you're working?
I actually only need the clay, and I work a lot from photographs. If I do portraiture, I will have sitters, but very, very briefly. And that's a big difference, obviously, in my new life, is that I am alone and I love it.
From the Neck Up was the title of your first exhibition in 2014. It was right. David Hare, your husband, that thought
yes.
of that. And you referred to yourself at the time as the oldest debutante in London history.
Yes, it's
a nerve-wracking thing to be a certain age and to say, this is what I'm doing now, this is serious, this is my work. How did you find that process?
No, I was not nervous because I've been sculpting for over 30 years, quietly on the side. And I always knew one day I will show my work. But I didn't want to do it while I was a designer. I wanted to stop one thing and be out with the next thing.
In that first exhibition in 2014, the range of busts that you presented were really of people who happened to be your close friends, but they happened to be household names too, people like Dame Judi Dench, Bill Nye, Helena Bonham Carter, and so on. Your next exhibition is of hands and arms this time. Why is that interesting?
The next one. Well, after the portraits, I thought, what is there that is as expressive of a person? But the hands, your hands are always present and they move without you actually consciously moving them. And the hands that I decided to sculpt were the hands of people doing things with their hands. There is a glazier, there is a baker, there is an embroiderer.
Nicole Fari, 40 years, as we know, in fashion, you've come in here today wearing what might be the most perfect denim shirt I've ever clapped eyes on. What's your...
It's 40 years old.
That only makes it even more annoying. Yeah. What's your relationship with fashion now? Do you care at all?
I don't. I don't read magazines. I don't go shopping. But I always care about my old clothes. I love my old clothes. And I have kept, luckily, over the years, my favourite in each collection. So everything I've got is old but can be worn forever.
Let's go to the first disc. Tell me what this is briefly and why you've chosen it.
Well, last year I went to the Pismash Festival and I heard Anthony Marwood playing the violin and playing that piece. I was totally transported by that piece of music. And I will always remember, and I think he will as well, is when he finished at the interval, I saw him in the garden. I rushed to him, embraced him and thanked him for my discovery of this incredible piece of music. Thank you.
Tchaikovsky's Trio for Piano, Violin and Cello in A minor with Marta Argerich on piano, Guidon Kremer on violin and Misha Maisky on cello. So, Nicole Farr, you grew up in Nice in the south of France. Both your parents were Sephardic Jews from Turkey. Your father had been brought up in Turkey by Jesuits, I think, and he spoke French. Tell me a bit more about him particularly.
I adored my father. He was the nicest man I've ever met. He was happily living in Turkey until his dad died. He was, I think, 15, 16. And when he died, my grandmother found it very difficult to carry on bringing her kids up. So my father said, well, I speak French. Why don't I go and travel and see if I can make a living elsewhere? And then I will ask the family to come and live with me. And a friend of his was already selling rugs in France. So he went to Marseille, met his friend. His friend said, well, here are some rugs. Why don't you go and sell these rugs?
So adventurous, entrepreneurial, spirited. He must have had lots of energy and determination to do that. But you say the nicest man you think you've ever met.
He was such a good man.
What were his qualities as a father that make you say that?
He was radiating love. Physically, he was a beautiful man, and he never found any fault in anyone. He was just goodness.
Was he a successful salesman?
No. He was enough to be able to get his mother back. But no, he was not a very successful man in his business, but he enjoyed everything he had. He didn't want more, you know, where my mother was different. She was more pushy and authoritarian.
And your mother is still alive.
My mother lives with me. She's over 100.
And you say, you know, a strong personality. Tell me, do you think that was because she felt she had to be, because your father maybe had a softer heart?
Well, I don't know. Maybe she didn't have to be, but she still is strong.
She still is over 100.
Yes, telling me off. For example, she always thought I didn't know how to dress and how she hated my hair, too much hair. She always would like me to have it very short. And she never accepted my way of life. But I have to say, when I was 17 and I wanted to leave Nice because I thought this town was far too little for me, my father didn't want me to. He was very traditionalist and he thought a girl has to stay at home until she gets married. My mother said, let her go. And she was fighting with him for me to go. So I owe her to have been able to go to Paris when I was 18 to do what I wanted.
Let's have your next choice. It's your second, Nicole Farr.
The next one is Ne me quitte pas by Jacques Brel. And, you know, when you are 17, 18, you're romantic and you feel you're going to meet that big love and you will never want him to leave you. Whatever you do in life, you want him to stay with you.
Ne me quitte pas, je t'inventerai des mots insensés que tu comprendras. Je te parlerai de ces amants-là qui ont vu deux fois leur cœur s'embraser. Je te raconterai l'histoire de ce roi mort de n'avoir pas pu te rencontrer. Ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas.
That was Jacques Brel and Ne me quitte pas. Nicole Farr, I said in the introduction that as a little girl, I had read that you designed little clothes to hang on to your dolls.
Yes.
Tell me more about those.
They were paper dolls that I drew, and I drew the clothes, summer, winter, skiing, swimsuit for the beach, with little pegs, you know, and then I would dress my little dolls and sadly, my mother threw everything away when I left her niece. But it's a shame because they were really, really nice.
And the Turkish aunts then, the ones that took a lot of care of their fashion and that took you remarkably to these couture shows. I mean, that's a very exclusive environment.
That was wonderful.
Tell me, first of all, about your aunts. How did they look? How did they dress?
One was my father's sister, and she had a couturier who was making her clothes. But at the time you could buy, I don't think they still exist, paper patterns after the couture collection, which were kind of copies of the couture. And she would go to the shows with her couturière and say, oh, I like this, I like that. And she had all her dress made for her. So when I was 14, 15, I would spend the month of August in Paris with her and she will take me.
Just conjure the scene for me, if you would, because, you know, people, we all think, well, we sort of have seen the snapshots and we might read the odd fashion magazine where we get a flavour of what goes on at a couture show. But then, during the 60s, tell me what it was like.
Well, obviously, at Yves Saint Laurent, for example, it was a very small room where everybody was sitting on gilded chairs, and it was much more intimate. It was not a big show like fashion shows became in my time, and even more probably today, I don't know.
And at 15, what sort of young girl were you? How were you dressing? What were you thinking? What were you interested in?
Well, because my mother had a say, I had very short hair.
Oh.
And curly but very short. And then I was always dressed in trousers and T-shirt. And that was my uniform for many, many years to come.
It's extraordinary to hear that, you know, you had this close crop, this sort of short hair. It's sort of your signature. Your hair for so many years is your signature. I think when we think of Nicole Fari, we think of this magnificent mane of tumbling curls. When did you start to grow it? Was that And I sort of denote a kind of undercurrent of spikiness between you and your mother. Was that always present? Is that true? Yes.
Yeah, still today. I mean, I hate her and I love her. You know? And I think she does the same. I mean, when she came to live with me, she was 95. She was losing her eyesight. So I thought she was living in Nice and she couldn't carry on living on her own. So I said to her, come and stay with me. And she thought she'll stay a few months and go back. But eventually she stayed for good. And she kept telling me, but I never got on with you. What am I doing with you?
And how do you answer that?
Well, I said, well, you're stuck. you go in a home. And I never wanted her to go in a home. So we are stuck together.
Tell me about your next piece of music, Nicole Fari. What's this? It's your third.
Ah, well, then when I went to Paris, I was 18 and I spent my time listening to jazz. And I discovered the king of soul, Muddy Waters.
Well, now I'm getting late over in the evening. I feel like blowing my horn. When I woke up this morning, all I had was gone. I'm getting late over in the evening, man. Now I feel like blowing my horn. Well, now woke up this morning, all I had was gone. Well, books went to the ocean, ocean running into the sea. But don't find my baby, somebody gone, sure bury me. Books went to the ocean, man, that ocean.
That was Muddy Waters and I Feel Like Going Home. Indeed, I'm about to come to the part, Nicole, where you do absolutely the opposite. Home was Nice, but you decided that it wasn't quite big enough for you.
Exactly.
And the life you wanted to live. You went to Paris, you were right about 18, and you went there to study art and fashion. At the Studio Berceau. How would you spend your days?
The first year I stayed with some cousins of my parents. And I did not enjoy having people overlooking at my life, because for me, going to Paris was to go towards freedom. And luckily, the second year, I had a tiny little bedroom on the top floor of a building.
You see them in Paris, it's always where probably the maid would have been in the grand
house. They call them chambre de bonne. We could hardly see the sky, actually, from my room. But I was free. So I didn't have a kitchen, so every morning I would go to a cafe to have my breakfast. Then I will go to my fashion course. I didn't really enjoy the technical side of fashion, so I skipped that to go to a cinema.
I mean, can you pattern cut? Would you be?
No. No, because I never learned. I thought I will find, I'm sure, some people much more gifted than me for that kind of thing in life, which I did. And I do other things that I love.
And so to earn money as a student, you started sort of freelance selling these sketches that you had done. These would be fashion sketches then.
Yes. every morning in my cafe, I would go through the companies and call them and say, can I come and show you my sketches? And I was still at school, but I was already selling my work. Some of my first clothes, which gave me my first contract, I had drawn little bags in the same fabric, matching the skirt or the jacket, attached by a belt. And I went into a company called Pierre d'Albi to show my sketches. And they thought, oh, that's amusing, you know. And anything you could do which was out of the normal would be accepted because people were hungry for novelty. So it was the beginning of prêt-à-porter.
And in any successful life, of course, timing plays a very important part. It was the early 70s when you met a man called Stephen Marks, who would go on to become one of our most successful fashion entrepreneurs. He started French Connection, the label itself, in 1972. You were chief designer there. What was your vision? What were you trying to do?
Oh, it was wonderful. Stephen had gone to India and came back with some clothes which he sold and created the label French Connection. And he said to me, next time, you must go because there is so much you can do in that country. The fabrics were fantastic, cheesecloths, things you couldn't find here. The embroidery was magnificent. It was the opening of a new world for me.
And did you have a woman in mind? Was there somebody in your creative head that you were designing for?
I always designed for myself, really, to please myself, to do things that I knew I would wear. I never wore dresses, ever. So it was more difficult when Stephen said to me, Nicole, you know, young girls, they do like wearing dresses. You must wear dresses. So I invented that young girl who could be me if I were to wear dresses.
Let's have some more music, Nicole Fari. Tell me about this. It's your fourth. What are we going to hear?
It's La Calas singing La Wali. When I started sculpting in my early 30s, I listened a lot to opera, and the voice was something that made me want to sculpt, and La Calas in particular, because the tragic life of that woman, the beauty of that woman, that sensual voice, all that moved my guts and made me sculpt.
Well then, I'll go far away from Catalanese La Wali, sung by Maria Callas with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Tullio Serafin. So, Nicole Fari, you and Stephen Marks had a professional and also a personal relationship. I can't help thinking there must have been an intensity about that at the time. You know, you're in the fashion business together, you're also in the relationship business together. What do you remember of those times?
We worked well together. But it was quite tumultuous. I remember days where I will throw the sketches to his face and take the train back to Paris with my daughter as a baby. But we had a wonderful time. So I owe him a lot, and I love him dearly, and we are best friends.
And, you know, working at that time, as you say, French Connection, it was a thriving business. It was a high street brand, and there you were as its chief designer, with then a little baby to look after. How did you manage all of that? What were the logistics like?
I just had a great nanny, and I have a great daughter who understood. I remember saying to her, oh, I'm so sorry, darling. I'm going to have to go to India again, and I'm going to leave you. Do you mind? And she said, Mommy, I love you. I will always remember. She never minded because she loved me and she knew I loved her. Our bond, her and I, is extremely strong.
You took that big step in 1982 then of launching the Nicole Fari label. I say a big step. Did it feel like a big step to put your name, to put your person to a label?
No. Stephen had a company called Stephen Marks, which I was designing the clothes for. And little by little, his name disappeared and my name appeared. The thing that changed was that I think I improved as a designer and I became much more affirmative of my own style.
The question of style, of course, is an entirely subjective thing, and people like what they like, and lots of different people like lots of different things. But as you've described it, you were designing for really yourself, for the sort of clothes that you wanted to wear. And you said at one point that they were sensual clothes, but not overtly sexual, because you didn't want women to be frightened of wearing them, to feel like they were a prisoner in their own clothes.
I always felt that sensuality is something very, very refined. You don't even have to wear clothes with a big décolletage to be attractive. You know, it comes from the eyes, it comes from the way you speak. So for me, being corseted in clothes is just ridiculous. What for? I don't think you add anything to yourself. I never wanted to put my bosom in the face of people.
Nicole Fay, it's time for your fifth. Tell me about this.
Well, this is my love for not only jazz, but also cinema. Big treat is to see at least one movie a day, which I carry on doing. And I saw this movie, Ascenseur pour l'échafaud. And Miles Davis recorded the soundtrack over one night session. And it's an incredible piece of music.
That was Miles Davis playing Générique from the soundtrack to Ascenseur pour l'échafaud. I want to rewind for a moment, Nicole Fay, to a little... It was a dinner party, I think, back in the 1980s, and a friend was sculpting a little wine cork at the table.
That's right. It's like a revelation. I suddenly realised, because I was not really satisfied with my life as a designer. I felt always something was missing. And when I saw her, I said to her, what are you doing with this cork? And she said, I'm a sculptor. I said, but this is it. This is what I want to be. And I said, well, how can I get there? And she said, well, I know somebody who gives evening classes. Why don't you go and see her? And her name was Jean Gibson. She gave me a lump of clay. She said, I will only take you if you can do something with this. She said, make a torso. I was so emotional. I went to my car. She said, I'll take you on, when she saw what I had done. And I went and cried.
So interesting.
I've been sculpting ever since.
But for somebody who had, and I understand it was a business, and the fashion business is a demanding mistress and you have to get the collections out. It was, however, also for you a creative process. Yes, it was this other thing that somehow emotionally you connected with. What is it, as you are working with clay, that is so powerful?
It comes from the guts. The first moment I touched the clay is totally, totally emotional. And still now, you know, after all those years, I just go into, I've got a dustbin where I keep my clay. I just put my hand in the clay and I feel it. It's like touching the earth. I tried different medium over the years. And Eduardo Parlozzi, who became my friend, said to me, why don't you try plaster? I tried stone. I tried wax. Nothing does it for me like touching the clay.
And the artist and sculptor, as you just said, the late Sir Eduardo Parlozzi, he was somebody really who became, would it be fair to say, he became your mentor, really, artistically?
He did. When I met David, who became my husband, I was so happy, I stopped sculpting. And Eduardo, who I knew already, was really upset. And he said, happiness is not suited to an artist. Go back to sculpt. And he started coming every Wednesday. I would not go to work. So he did become my mentor, my teacher.
And he enabled you to see, you once said, endless beauty that was all around you. Well, that, isn't that a skill? How did he manage to do that?
He took me out to shows, to museums. We walked in the street and he used to say, look up there, look at this. He would pick up stuff in the street. He saw something creative in everything and he opened my eyes.
We're going to hear your next piece of music, Nicole Fari. Tell me what we're going to hear next. This is your sixth.
This is a very important piece of music for me. It's a song which is not only anti-war, but also about people standing for what they believe and who they are. So I've decided to dedicate it to Mohamed Ali.
Monsieur le Président, je vous fais une lettre que vous lirez peut-être. Si vous avez le temps, je viens de recevoir mes papiers militaires pour partir à la guerre avant mercredi soir. Monsieur le Président, je ne veux pas la faire.
That was Serge Rejani and Les Déserteurs. So you met the man who's now your husband, the playwright Sir David Hare, in 1991, I think it was. You had been asked to design something for a play of his.
I was helping my friend Bob Crowley to design the couple of dresses of the leading lady for a play of David, Murmuring Judges. Richard Eyre, who was directing the play, invited me for dinner. There were a party after the play. I had seen David the night before on television, and when he talked, I thought, oh my God, this man is talking to me. I can understand what he's saying. The next day, I was not going to go and see the play. But after I'd seen him, I decided I will go and see the play without knowing that I will meet him. But when he came in to the restaurant, I saw him and he looked at me and
it was a coup de foudre, was it?
It was a coup de foudre.
Tell me then about the design of your wedding rings.
His name, obviously, is David Hare. So I thought, I want a ring that is only for him and me, that nobody else will ever have.
I'm looking at it now. You just passed it to me.
I sculpted two hairs running after each other forever.
You describe yourself as a very faithful person. You hold on to things. You keep friendships going for a long time. I mean, what does that mean in practice? Do you have treasures that are your touchstones through
Not
life?
Not so much about inanimate objects, but I'm attached to people, yeah. And my friends, I want them for the rest of my life. And as Rilke said, they are the guarant of your memory. And, you know, if you forget something, you always have a friend to remind you how you were or what happened then. And it's so important.
What about your attachment to your homeland? I mean, you know, a childhood in Nice and then living in Paris for so many years, you've kept your exquisite accent. Do you sometimes pine for home? Do you feel like a foreigner in a foreign land still?
I don't feel British at all. But I do feel French, although the fact that my family came from elsewhere, I'm more attached to France probably than I am to England. But I can't say I'm desperate to go back or I'm happy where I am.
Tell me about your next piece of music. This is your seventh.
So this is for David. This is The Man I Love, sung by Sarah Vaughan, which I kept listening to because after a few weeks of going out with him, he went off on holiday at Christmas for a week. But I was desperate because he had left me behind. And so I kept listening to Sarah Vaughan, The Man I Love.
Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. you look at me and smile. I understand in a little while he'll take my hand.
That was Sarah Vaughan and The Man I Love, music and lyrics there by George and Ira Gershwin. So, Nicole Fiery, in 2010, after a few years, it would be fair to say, of struggling a bit financially, the Nicole Fiery brand was sold, and it's a tough business, the fashion business. And so the remaining shops and concessions don't have anything to do with you now.
No, yet, not at all.
There's your name.
I actually try to avoid passing by my stores. I have absolutely nothing to do with it. I stayed in the business when it was sold at the beginning for a couple of years, but it changed hands so quickly. After 1 year, it changed hands, and I was very happy the day I left, and I don't want to look back.
What would you like your creative legacy to be? When I've been talking to you today, it's very clear to me the most engaged you are is when you're talking about the thing that you are in the middle of doing right now, which is creating pieces of sculpture. But does it feel to you as though that's what you'd really like to be known for?
You know, I did the head of Thomas Gainsborough for the Gainsborough House. And when I went, I never had that with my clothes, and I saw my clothes on thousands of people. And I know clothes get destroyed little by little. There will be nothing left of me in fashion. But that head of Gainsborough will remain in that museum. And then I felt I'm going to leave a little mark of my passage here on Earth. So it felt really good.
You're going to be cast away to this desert island, and I'm imagining, you know, there are endless possibilities for your creative juices to flow here. What do you think will inspire you?
Well, I don't know what will inspire me, but I will have the sand. I hope it's a sandy island, but if it's not, if it's stone, I will make something out of the stone.
Let's go to your final piece of music, Nicole Fiery. Tell me about this. What's your eighth?
So the last piece I chose are the four last songs by Richard Strauss. I absolutely adore the piece you're going to hear, Spring. It's something that stirs my inside.
That was Richard Strauss's Spring from his four last songs, sung there by Gundula Janowitz with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So, Nicole, it's time for me to cast you away. I'm going to give you some books to keep you company along with
yes. The
discs. You get the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible.
Thanks.
Do you mean it? You don't look like you mean thanks there.
Oh, I find Shakespeare quite difficult, and I've read the Bible when I was young, and I don't wish to read it again.
Okay, so what's your choice of books?
So my choice is Marcel Proust, À la recherche du temps perdu. I've got a beautiful edition, which my mother gave me when I was 15, and I actually never read it completely.
And what about your luxury then? What's that going to be?
Well, I don't want the luxury, because I thought I could take my husband with me.
No.
And I heard I can't. So I've been thinking. And actually, I just thought, what else? And I just don't care for anything else.
Oh,
really.
You've gone all French on me now, Nicole. You may be the first castaway we've ever had not to take the luxury, but there you are. Which of these eight tracks would you like to save from the waves?
I'd like the four last songs.
Nicole Fiery, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Kirsty.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.